started. I think we'll probably have some people join up with us as we go. But as Jeffrey said, we should reward those of you who are here by starting on time.
That's so, my rule.
He has a lot of experience with museum programs, so we'll go with his lead on that. I'm Terry Thornton. I'm curator of education, and we have started this really exciting program of Sundays at the Modern, or Sundays with the Modern, which is a tour program every Sunday at 1 o'clock. We do skip a few Sundays, so it's advisable to look at the schedule for holidays and such, but every Sunday you have the opportunity to hear from somebody with a very unique and informed perspective on the works of art, either in the collection or special exhibition or aspects of the architecture. So today we have Jeffrey Grove with us, and Jeffrey is the Hoffman Family Senior Curator of Contemporary Art, which he began last September 2009, so this is your one-year anniversary.
Uh-huh. At Dallas, so they don't mistake it for here.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. Yes, at the DMA in Dallas, exactly. We don't have a Hoffman Family Senior Curator of Contemporary Art, but yes, in Dallas at the DMA. And there, Jeffrey's duties include leading the museum's Department of Contemporary Art and overseeing its exhibitions, programming, publications, and acquisitions programs as such. He was previously the Wyland Family Curator of Modern Art. We have some competition. Modern and Contemporary Art at the High Museum of Art in, of course, Atlanta. He was Associate Curator of Contemporary Art at the Cleveland Museum of Art. And the founding, I think this is very curious and interesting. The founding curator of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., so invite.
See, now that people know.
Look at that. Okay, I can see. We're going to change that today. Jeffrey has developed numerous exhibitions and scholarly publications and is currently organizing with the Walker Art Center a mid-career survey of the artist Jim Hodges, who is a personal favorite. And I keep, as I get to know more and more about Jeffrey, I understand more and more why I've been attracted to him and his work, because we share so many sensibilities, I think. Jim Hodges has been here for one of the Tuesday evenings, and I have to say it was very eccentric and perhaps my very favorite Tuesday evening lecture. So I understand why I like Jeffrey so much, more and more. Jeffrey also received critical acclaim for the exhibitions After 1968, Contemporary Artists and the Civil Rights Legacy, 2008 to 2010, and I think that's a really interesting premise for an exhibition. Morris Lewis Now, an American Master Revisited, which was ran 2006 to 2007. And, of course, you know that we have some very prominent, interesting Morris Lewis paintings, which unfortunately are not up. So we have to bring Jeffrey back, obviously.
Yeah, I was sad that Delatep isn't up. It's one of the best Morris Lewis paintings.
Is that right? We have occasion to bring
back. And I
begged
Fort Worth for that picture when I was organizing that exhibition, by the way.
Very nice. So we have occasion to bring you back. Other major exhibitions include the Mikhail Borman's drawings, 2005 to 2006, at the Kunst Museum in Basel. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing the artist's name
Mikhail
correctly.
Mikhail Borman's. Mm-hmm.
Yes, and it's interestingly enough, that is an artist who I came across in London, and just absolutely it buckled my knees when
Amazing.
I saw that work. And then also Metascape, Torben Geiler, Benjamin Edwards, Julie Merteau, and Yutaka Son. 2003, when he was at the Cleveland Museum. Jeffrey holds a doctorate in art history from Case Western Reserve University, a master's of arts degree in art history and archaeology from the University of Missouri, and a bachelor of fine arts degree in industrial design from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. I think we're very fortunate to have Jeffrey in our community, and I'm so glad he's here today to talk to us about aspects of our collection. So with that, please join me in welcoming Jeffrey Grove.
Thank you. And thank you all for coming out on a busy Sunday. But I'm glad that we're a small group because it makes it easier to have a real conversation. And as you probably intuited from Terry's introduction, I myself have a rather eclectic sensibility and past. And one of those areas of specialization in this peripatetic career of mine has been abstract expressionism. It's where I really cut my teeth in terms of scholarship when I was in graduate school. So I'm going to talk about Jackson Pollock in some depth, and then maybe talk about some of the other pictures around here, because Jackson Pollock is simultaneously one of the most famous American artists of the post-war era and also one of the most misunderstood artists of the post-war era. And time and scholarship hasn't done much to diminish many of the misunderstandings or misinformation surrounding his career. And it's really terrific at Fort Worth to have two paintings that in a way sort of bracket Pollock's career, and particularly the arc of his career for which he's perhaps the most well-known. And if you think about Jackson Pollock, what do you usually think of?
Drunk and tortured. Eyes closed every day.
Drunk,
which is what I
knew of him. Tortured, violent. You said eyes closed.
Yeah.
Drunk. Jackson.
I think
he's a
strong personality.
Strong personality. Drips. And this is what really defines Jackson Pollock, those paintings which are often called drip paintings that are sometimes expansive in scale up to 15 feet, sometimes much smaller on a single sheet of paper, where he actually did pour, drip, squirt, never fling paint onto a canvas which was generally laid on the floor of his studio. But that really defines about a four-year period in his work. He started doing that in 1947, and by 1951 had pretty much concluded that practice. He died at age 44. He looked like he was about 68 when he died at age 44, because he did indeed have a very difficult life. He had a very tortured sort of psychological existence. And all of that backdrop is important for understanding how he evolved to become this major force in American art, because he was utterly nonverbal. And, you know, if he were alive today, I'm sure he would be diagnosed as having Asperger's syndrome or something like this, because he began drinking at age 15 quite heavily, because that's probably what projected him far enough outside of his own self-consciousness to be able to communicate in some way, even if it was often in a non-productive way with other people. But what really happened, where the magic happened, was when he was in his painting. And he refers to, and he could be quite eloquent when he was speaking about painting, and in 1949, when he gave an interview, he said, "I am myself when I'm in my painting." And he was really talking about that period when he was in East Hampton, in his studio, creating those magical, skein-like works. And I hope that you've seen some of those in other museums. And of course, I think probably MoMA has the most beautiful example, Lavender Mist from 1950. But come a little bit closer, since we're a small group, we can. Just a little bit more biographical background, because I think it's useful and interesting. Jackson Pollock was born in Cody, Wyoming in 1912. And so henceforth, he becomes codified as a Western artist. But in fact, before he was a year old, they'd moved to Phoenix, Arizona, and then within the same year to California, where he was actually raised. And he was raised in towns quite near to Los Angeles, and he went to proper high schools and tradesman schools, although he did drop out of high school at age 17 because, again, he was already getting into a lot of trouble, let's say, and really not excelling in typical classwork, but already his talent as an artist was beginning to be expressed. He was also the baby of the family. He's one of five boys, and he was, in fact, quite the mama's boy, and he was protected and cared for by his older brothers up until the time in his late 20s when he married Lee Krasner. He lived with any number of his brothers and their wives, lived in a spare room. He wasn't quite adept at taking care of himself, and there was always someone nurturing that, because he had this incredible talent, and he was incredibly frustrated trying to express it, you might say. But what really led to the great evolution was when he moved to New York and moved in with his brother Charles and his wife to attend the Art Students League, where his brother was already enrolled in school. And does anyone know who his mentor and teacher was there? American Regionalist painter Thomas Hart Benton. which if you think about what you know about Pollock and what you know about Thomas Hart Benton, you can't imagine two more divisive figures, perhaps. But in fact, they were quite close. Pollock considered Benton and his wife almost parental figures. He spent summers with them in Massachusetts and, in fact, studied with Benton until Benton in, 1940, what year he went to be the director of the Kansas City Art Institute. So again, you know, Benton, who's from Missouri, is thought of as this very Midwestern artist, but the great fecund part of his career was spent in New York City. You know, he was quite sophisticated as well. But if you look at this painting, which was painted in 1938, and just think about a few things that we've talked about, look at the convergence of elements and ideas, and think about Thomas Hart Benton and those twisting torsos in Thomas Hart Benton's work, and even the palette, and also the figures that often appear in Benton's, the elongated figures. And I think when I think about Benton, I think about El Greco, and I think about Mannerist painting and those elongated, stretched figures. And all of these artists, including Jackson Pollock, were very, very well informed of art history. And he lived in New York, and he went to the museums, and he went to the Museum of Modern Art, which in the 30s, in the late 30s, was doing, not that they don't now, but they were doing truly groundbreaking exhibitions because they were the first time that certain elements of European art were being shown in 1937. And I have to look at my crib notes only because it's important. In 1936, MoMA did a show called Cubism and Abstract Art. It was one of the first shows of its kind. And the next year they did a show, Fantastic Art, Dada and Surrealism. So I think that you know the climate in New York in the 30s. There were many, many European immigrants escaping persecution in Europe, migrating to the United States. Many of those people like Mondrian, like Hans Hofmann, were artists themselves and became instructors in these schools or even set up their own studio schools. Jackson Pollock's wife, Lee Krasner, studied under Hans Hofmann at the Art Students League. They exerted great influence, and they also brought European ideas, European philosophies, and began to spread them among these students. And something else to remember is that the art world was a very, very small place back then. Mark Rothko, Jackson Pollock, Clifford Still, Adolf Gottlieb, Philip Guston knew each other. They all lived in the same city. They went to the same bars. They went to the same talks. They went to the club together, and the club wasn't a country club. It was a group of people that got together and read and talked about, you know, issues and ideas, you know, a salon, if you will. As a matter of fact, Philip Guston, then Philip Goldstein, and Jackson Pollock went to high school together. So there are these arcs that were all colliding and coming together, Western, Eastern experiences, but all centered in New York at this really generative time in everyone's career. So Pollock, like many American artists who had a somewhat traditional matriculation in art schools, at the time it was the trinity of European modernism was the Holy Grail, Picasso, Matisse, and Miro. And you look at almost any American artist who was going through or coming out of their school years at that time, and you can easily begin to pick out elements of that. And I think that Picasso obviously immediately comes to mind here. But then there are also very distinctive individuating elements here that are already uniquely Pollock's, and I think filter out through the rest of his work even something that looks maybe as dissonant compared to this as this later painting from 1952. So if anyone, I don't want to put anyone on the spot, but if anyone would like to venture some suggestions about what you see when you look at this painting, I'd welcome that type of interaction. Masks that echo Picasso. Movement, sort of a sense of active motion. What about this? Fetal, absolutely. Fetal, and then this sort of dentine shape here, something coming from the fetus and, you know, dropping, ejecting into the mouth of this consuming figure. And think about these kind of roiling, organic, paramecia-type organisms. But then they also gestate into full figures in these masks. And it's a collision of almost, you know, swirling motion of these masks, almost one ingesting the other. But in a way, if you look at this in particular, and then when we'll look at a few other works, there, Jackson Pollock, and actually the DMA, where I'm privileged to work, has one of Jackson Pollock's late works from 1953 called Portrait in a Dream. And it's one of the only paintings he ever acknowledged was a self-portrait. He painted another self-portrait in 1933. But I have this fantasy, because I've spent a lot of time looking at Pollock's, that many, many, many of his works are in fact self-portraits. And I would even venture to say that if you look at his 1933 self-portrait, you see a likeness here. Now, I'm sure that this is heretical, and if anyone from the Pollock Krasner Foundation finds out I said that, I'll be arrested. But I think this is one of the things that's so exciting about an artist like Pollock. You keep going back to the work, and new interpretations keep coming out. It's such an incredibly rich body of work created in a relatively short lifetime. In fact, the last 4 years of his life, he hardly painted at all. And also, just look at the way that it is painted. It's thickly embossed. It's built up many, many layers. It has a really thick density, which is quite different from what we think of later so-called abstract expressionists like Rothko, where they become very airy and light, and even Pollock's drip paintings. Now, that term I just used, abstract expressionist, I'm sure that you're all familiar with it. You've heard it many times applied to many artists. But in fact, and I use it all the time too, you know, we love our isms in our schools, minimalism, conceptualism, abstract expressionism, cubism. But just standing in this gallery and looking at 1, 2, 3, 4 different artists who've been called abstract expressionists, including Baziotti's over here, is there a lot really in common visually? Not necessarily. And even, it's a term that Pollock, it was really coined for the first time in reference to these artists, even though it appeared in literature in 1919, in a review in 1946 by Robert Coates, where he referred to the artists of this generation as abstract expressionists. And of course, he was connoting that they were being expressive in their painting and that it was abstract, i.e. non-representational. But of course, here you have something that is arguably representational, and in the painting we'll talk about in a minute, very clearly representational, even though it's referred to as an abstraction. So let's go over there. I think it's important to do that and then come back here. Yes, please.
Is that a male scientific sign for male in the left-hand corner?
Where are you?
Right there, the round with the arrow. No, yeah, right here. The round circle with the arrow.
Right. Oh, well, I don't think that that had been applied to male, female at that time, but it's definitely, there are stenographic figures in here and elements which, oh, I would be remiss not to talk about this now, we would do it later. Definitely Pollock was immersed in the visual language of other cultures and specifically obsessed with Northwest American Indian culture. And both he and his brother, and I looked through many of these volumes in the Pollock Krasner House, Smithsonian annuals about Northwestern, and it was called Eskimo then, we don't use that word anymore, culture, and they would annual books, you know, on the art. And he kept a set of 12 under his bed. It was one of the few possessions that he moved from apartment to apartment. And just as a little background, I said that I looked through all of those. When I was in graduate school, I, along with one of my professors, wrote the catalog raisonné of Lee Krasner, to whom Jackson Pollock was married. So I spent, and there's a wonderful Pollock Krasner House and Study Center in East Hampton where they lived. And back then in the 90s when I was doing this, it wasn't quite as sophisticated as it is now. And we actually stayed in the house. I slept in Jackson Pollock's bedroom. And at night, my professor and I listened to Jackson Pollock and Lee Krasner's jazz records and looked through their books. Because they were both, even though he wasn't particularly literate, he was very interested in literature. And she was very sophisticated and in fact, a huge influence on Pollock. In fact, he owes his life and career to her because he wouldn't have had his first show if Lee Krasner hadn't introduced this coterie of people in New York who made it happen. He would have been just drinking himself to death in this studio apartment on Houston Street at the time. And now's as good a time as any because it's really, this is all part of the story. Lee Krasner and Jackson Pollock, well, they met peripherally in 1936 at a talk where she said that he was drunk and said something filthy in her ear, but, you know, and she paid no attention to him. But 6 years later, John Graham, who was a major influence, again, on this group of artists, a European who'd immigrated to the States, wrote a book called Dialectics and Art in 1937 that was one of these widely read tracts by the artists, you know, who were interested in philosophy and issues of the mind as well as painting. And Lee Krasner was quite friendly with John Graham, and John Graham curated an exhibition at French and Company, which was a very influential gallery at the time, which was juried by a number of other influential artists, including Mondrian, who said that Pollock was the best American painter that he'd seen, even though he was unknown at this time. And Lee Krasner, Clement Greenberg referred to Lee Krasner as having the best eye in New York at the time. And she, in fact, prided herself on that. And when she was included in the show herself, the only woman, not coincidentally at that time in 1942, included alongside Pollock and many other influential artists and lesser-known artists, she said, "Who the hell's Jackson Pollock?" And she didn't know who he was, so she found out who he was, and she went to a studio and introduced herself. And she likened the experience, and this painting was in his studio when she went to see him for the first time. And she said that it was an experience, it felt like the floor dropping out. Not because she like immediately fell madly in love with him, she immediately fell madly in love with the painting and realized that this, you know, was a force the likes of which no one had ever seen. And at that point, she really basically began devoting herself to him and his work for the next few years. So we'll go over from 1938. To 1952. And the painting over there on paper is also 1952, I believe, isn't it?
I think so.
Or 1951, 1952. So we can talk about those two in tandem. But again, it's important, I think, to get a little bit close to this work. And now if someone else will be the brave person and tell me what they see at first blush looking at this painting. Eyes? A woman. Breasts, a full figure.
Double breasts.
Double breasts.
And a person on behind.
And is that person? Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? So, I mean, the first few times I looked at this painting, I saw a figure. And then I saw another figure. And next time you're over at Dallas, look at Portrait in a Dream, our painting that has his self-portrait on the right side. And on the left side is a figure very much like this. But two things that I also see is I see a figure and I see a figure behind it, and it's almost like it could be you know, like a vampire coming in having sex. What's it called? A succubus? Mm-hmm. You know, the apparition that comes in the night and envelops you in your dream. I mean, because what else? What is this this framework? This very deliberate, you know, shrine almost around these figures. And now I'm going to go, because shrine made me think of this, because what I see when I see this is not necessarily a consuming figure, but I think of a pietà. I mean, could this not be a body, and this is the leg of the prone figure being held by the mother figure? Or a conflation of the two. I think it's a productive way to think about it, because Pollock, in 1945, said that he wished that he could be Leonardo. And, which just, again, shows that his familiarity, you know, thinking of El Greco, with iconic art history and an awareness of where, you know, the genesis of many of the touchstones of contemporary modern art are embedded in centuries of art past. So I think that he, and what's also interesting is this kind of language of what's going on with the feet, you know. And you look at some of Lee Krasner's paintings from the 50s, and she also has this, his late painting, Eastern the Totem, and some of her paintings from 1955. They had a dialogue. And when he was painting these paintings in the barn, and let me just roll back again a little bit. They moved out to, they became a couple in 1942. In 1945, to really get him out of New York, she suggested that they move to East Hampton. They'd visit another artist friend in the Springs who had a place there. They scraped together some money, got an advance from Peggy Guggenheim, who was then representing him, and bought this broken-down farmhouse where I used to stay in East Hampton in the Springs. It had no heat, it had no indoor toilet, it had no hot water. And what it did have was a beautiful view onto the bay, Accabonic Creek, and a big barn in the back. So they moved in the first year through the winter. They basically made the home habitable. And then the next year, Pollock had the barn moved because it blocked the view out to Accabonic Creek over to the side, and moved into that as his studio. He'd been painting in a bedroom upstairs, hence the scale of his work at that time was maybe the largest painting was 4 by 5 feet. And that last great series of paintings that he painted in that house are called the Accabonic Creek series. And if you're ever in the Art Institute of Chicago, they have my most adored Jackson Pollock painting from 1946 called The Key, which he painted there. And it was one of the last pictures he painted in the house. And then he moved out to this still then unheated studio that also had no electricity. So he painted during the day. There were windows cut into the side. And he people think of it being that studio being the size of this room, but in fact, it's about 20 by 20. It's a very tight square. And if you're ever out there and can go and you can take the tour, it's really an amazing thing to go into this studio and walk on the floor where all the paint is dripped and all of the evidence of the actions that happened in there are recorded, really inscribed on the floor. So he moved out of the bedroom into the barn. Lee Krasner moved upstairs into the bedroom. She'd been painting in what was the living room, and painting quite small paintings herself because of the scale of the room. But this is 1952. He began those large works in the barn in 1946. And by 1951, he was enjoying a certain level of success. MoMA had bought one of his pictures. He'd had a few exhibitions in other countries, although he'd never traveled to Europe himself. And he had stopped drinking. This is the other important thing. Almost all of the drip paintings from 1946 to 1950 were painted when he was stone cold sober. So even though he was quite alcoholic and did create work that time, these mature works that we think of were the product of this great period of sobriety when he was being treated by a doctor in East Hampton. And I actually found out he was prescribed Milltown. Does everyone remember that?
Yeah.
Wasn't that what they called like a mother's little helper in the 50s? Well, that's what he took. Has everyone seen one of these pictures before, these famous pictures of Jackson Pollock painting, which Hans Namuth started this project in 1950, and included photographing him in the studio painting, and then he also asked Pollock to paint outside on a sheet of glass, and Hoffman filmed underneath him. Well, this filming was done Thanksgiving 1950. It was quite cold outside, and it was quite long day, and at the end of that, and Pollock's family was visiting for Thanksgiving, he stormed into the house and got a drink and got drunk, and that was the end of it. So shortly thereafter, he sort of retracted from that scale of painting, rejecting the color, the vibrant color that you see in many of those drip paintings, and wrote in a letter to Alphonse Osorio, who was a friend of his, that he was eschewing color and that he was returning to the figure. And so in these still, he's sort of marrying these two. These are still being poured and dripped. And the way he did these was he still rolled out these long 20-foot sections of canvas, but he would work around it and paint a segment of it and then move along and paint another. And then later he and Krasner would decide, well, those two go together or that one's by itself. So you have some of these that are almost like diptychs or triptychs or ones that are single. And there's some great photographs, probably in here, but in other books, that show them on the floor and then hung up for inspection, as it were, where they would decide mutually what these paintings were and what they were going to be. So that's a really interesting process. But when Pollock showed these works in 1951, he was shellacked by the critics. I mean, nobody wanted to see this. And many people think that that compounded with other factors is what drove him on this downward trajectory. After these paintings in 1951 and 1952, he had a period where he painted about 6 major paintings and an 18-month period where he didn't paint a thing until, you know, his marriage was beginning to fall apart. In 1956, Lee Krasner sort of issued an ultimatum and said, I'm going to Europe for the summer. You figure out what you're going to do. And while she was in Europe, he'd hooked up with this tart. The only word that we can use, this young art student, opportunist. And they had gone into town, and he was driving drunk, and on the way back, crashed into a car, killing himself and her friend. So that was, you know, unfortunately, the end was not pretty, both in terms of his professional career or his private life. And in a way, it constructed the myth that surrounds Pollock of, you know, hard living, hard drinking, died young. But it was a very complex psychology all along that led to that. But you see in something, I think this is such a terrific painting. I mean, it's so powerful, and people, and that's why I'm glad that you have both of these, because they're the kinds of works that people don't look at enough when they think about Pollock, but they really hold the full story in them, along with the drip paintings for which he's so famous. And let's go back over, since you have a... Mm-hmm, please. No, please, I love questions.
Tell me again what the loops around the edges...
Well, I don't know, but I say, I just, you know, it sort of begins to create like a frame, you know, almost like a backdrop.
It could be the sheets of the bed.
It could be the sheets of the bed. It could be... The orange?
Uh-huh.
You know, I think that... It probably is from another painting, actually, because most of these are exclusively white. And it says that it's enamel. I think that it might be oil, because a lot of his paintings were enamel, but in 1951, I think he was using oil and thinning it.
It certainly looks more like oil at the top than it does.
There's a little blue in this
corner. Yeah, mm-hmm. And those could have been... from excesses from previous paintings, exactly. Or it could have been intentional. I don't know. But often you see them and there's no color.
Was this the era of not naming your painting because the viewer had to feel what he felt? Or did he start the painting tradition of not naming on the bed, not naming?
He didn't start it, but it very much was, I think, sort of an ethos in the air, because certainly many of his works up into the 40s he titled. And then I think it was because they wanted, many of these artists wanted people to move out of their own minds when they were looking at the work, like Rothko. They wanted to evoke an experience instead of preordaining what that experience would be, began to go to untitled. And, you know, your Morris Lewis painting's a great example. Morris Lewis never titled a single painting after 1941. And after he died and his widow discovered 600 paintings rolled up in the attic, they had to come up with a system just to keep track of them. So she began with the Hebrew alphabet, you know, went alpha, beta, you know, A, B, C, you know, and then moved on to the Greek alphabet and so forth. So they're completely arbitrary titles, and these, you know, were simply numbered.
No matter what we see in this, in one of Paul's paintings,
mm-hmm.
he never said, oh, when I painted that, that's what I was thinking of, correct?
He did sometimes.
Okay.
There are a few instances, of course, where he did, but he didn't necessarily, I mean, like, he referred to these being figural and referencing, you know, the earliest work that he did. He said, the earliest work that I did is present in the
so
in the late work.
So it really is the viewer's experience. It really doesn't have much to do. We don't know what he was thinking about. If he was thinking about anything consciously.
Correct. Correct. That's why I talk about, you know, sort of this biographical material, because it begins to give you a way to situate where this person was in their own life and in history as well. And let me tell you, East Hampton in 1950 was not East Hampton in 2000. I mean, it was the boondocks, and they were isolated, and, you know, there were friends. You know, Bradley Walker Tomlin lived next door. Willem de Kooning and Elaine de Kooning, with whom they were friendly at one point, lived, you know, down not too far away, but you know, it was a different world then, and people worked in isolation, and they went into the city, and it was always a disaster until they got back to the country. More questions about this work? Okay. I just wanted to finish up here because we've talked so much about these drip, so-called drip paintings. And something that's important to realize is that some of those words, those random things that are applied to him as, you know, certain recklessness of the way things, the paint's applied. When you look at, and this was a film as well, but when you look at these still photographs and you look at the canvases, the large canvases, you realize that they're not accidents, that they're premeditated performances in a way. And it's really quite, you know, when he was in his prime and he was quite sleek looking, you know, and even though, you know, maybe prematurely bald like some people, he's very elegant when he's painting. He's moving, you know, and you can see this, that he's figured out where the paint's going to go before it hits. And he's using these sticks and he's, you know, dripping and swirling. It's not like he's tossing it. He's applying it, and he's using a different methodology to apply it. And he's given a lot of credit for being, you know, the first artist to do this, but in fact, he really wasn't. Other artists had experimented with pouring paint from a distance and dripping paint. And his experiences in New York that were really important were his relationships with Orozco, the Mexican muralist in general, Siqueiros, Orozco, and Rivera, all of whom he met. And he also took workshops with Siqueiros and worked on a mural project with him. And those Mexican muralists were the bridge, just as the European surrealists were a bridge that had a huge effect on abstract expressionism. The Mexican muralists, both for the scale of their work and also the way they worked in the application of paint. And it was Siqueiros who had already in the 30s created paintings by pouring paint from above onto the canvas. But Pollock's the one who turned it into investing it in, on this sort of emotional, physical action. And that word action is another misnomer in a way, because Harold Rosenberg in 1952 wrote a very subsequently influential tract called The American Action Painters. And Pollock really disliked the article, mainly because it was really about Willem de Kooning. And it sort of gave this, again, skewed idea that wasn't fully realistic, that there was this huge number of painters working away somewhere and just, you know, frenziedly painting away. And I mean, when you look at de Kooning's painting at that time, it was frenzied in this way. It wasn't frenzied in this way. And Pollock, you know, what's been described as a frenzy is not really a frenzy. It's much more controlled and contained. And I use that word again, performance. And the way that he was moving, you know, off of the canvas and using the canvas in a different way, so that the painting itself becomes a record of its own making. And that's, you know, once again, sort of intuitively and philosophically, a really interesting idea that these artists were conscious of. They wanted the process of the making of the work to be part of it. And so this changes the future in huge ways. It leads to, in a way, conceptualism and process art. And I just, you know, I was walking around the galleries, and the, as everyone knows, the Gonzalez-Torres, I mean, that wouldn't exist if it weren't for Jackson Pollock, you know, via Alan Capro. So it's a really interesting historical trajectory.
I have just seen a documentary on Jackson Pollock, mm-hmm. And they actually interviewed Lou Krasner, and I think the interview with her took place after he had died. Mm-hmm.
Right.
As the brush. He never made contact with the canvas, but it wasn't drip. So that whole idea of flinging stuff around, she really took major issue. Mm-hmm. She tells her it's very protective of it, but she took major issue with that. She
right. Was, and it's true, and that's why this photographic record is so important, because it really shows how he created the painting. And then this one's great because it has, and come a little bit closer if you haven't seen it before, it has this these pebbles in it. Now, much has been made about Pollock being from the West and Indian sand painting. And he used sand and rubble in a lot of his work and mixed sand into the paint at times. But also, the detritus of the studio floor ended up in his painting sometimes, too. There's one in New York in the Met that has a cigarette butt in it. And any number of them have traces of his hand where the hand got in the paint. So he's literally inscribed himself into the canvas as well. So again, it takes on this autobiographical aspect. But this, you know, is wonderful because this is where he was using that thick enamel. And he also used not fine, you know, artist oil paints. He used house paint for a lot of these works because it was Duco house paint. It was what he could afford. And it was such a thick viscous, he could actually, you know, drop these pebbles into it. So you have nature, you know, intersecting with this, you know, very organic process of painting. And this is a perfect transition to that painting by Hans Hofmann right there. Because Hans Hofmann, and now this is where I'm going to wander around a little bit because there are just some nice connections of works here. Yes. I don't know. He certainly didn't in the studio. They listened to music a lot at night in their parlor, but...
What kind of music?
Mostly jazz and blues.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That painting reminds me of music and jazz. Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a whole... I mean, I don't want to plug any particular book, but this book, which was written by my professor, Ellen Landau, with whom I wrote the Lee Krasner Catalogue Raisonné, the introductory chapter is about the, you know, sort of the American male in the 50s and James Dean and outsiderness and music and jazz and, you know, all of these artists were in New York and they were going to the jazz clubs, and it was because that was alternative culture in a way, and it was a synthesis of arts, you know, that was really a rich flowering that, you know, led to in the 60s some really dramatic changes in how those art worlds intersected. But I just wanted to mention briefly Hans Hofmann because I mentioned his name earlier as being a teacher of Lee Krasner. And, you know, he's credited with, you know, his theories of opposition, push and pull, where a flat surface could both project and recede based on the color relationships. But Pollock did not particularly like Hofmann, and Hofmann was at his home one time and challenging him about his work and saying that you should paint from nature, and Pollock said, "Damn it, I am nature." So that's the pebbles in there. So sorry about that. What time is it, Terry? I just don't want to. Okay, I'll just hit on a few more things and then we'll wind up. So I just think that look at this painting by Adolf Gottlieb from 1961, and he began painting pictures of this type around 1956. Couldn't have happened without Pollock. Wouldn't have happened without Pollock. But interestingly, it's a completely different type of painting, and it's a different type of gesture, and it has maybe a different level of meaning. And interestingly, Gottlieb lived in East Hampton too, but there really wasn't a lot of cross-pollination or connection. But this happens to be an exquisite Gottlieb, by the way. I've seen a lot of them, and it's gorgeous and in great condition. But two things that are interesting, these orbs, he didn't paint these as easel paintings. Gottlieb usually painted these on the floor. And those orbs usually began as a pool of paint poured, and then he worked it out with a brush. So Pollock had an immediate influence on other artists, which is why when I think about what makes an artist significant is what's their influence. Not their influence only culturally, but their influence on other artists. And just speaking about that misnomer of abstract expressionism, when you look at Pollock, when you look at Gottlieb, and then you look at Clifford Still, I always think of Clifford Still as being something completely other, something completely different in a way. And Clifford Still was born in North Dakota, and he really grew up in Canada. And he was, of all of the artists who are labeled abstract expressionists, he was the least convinced by group activity, and sway of the critics, least likely to have a dialogue with other artists. He was extraordinarily suspicious and really wasn't part of that. Whereas someone like Robert Motherwell, who's from California, by the way, came from a very privileged life, spoke French, considered himself quite a philosopher himself. He was at the apex of this kind of critical intellectual life in New York and really fancied himself as an impresario in a way of cultivating the identity of the artist, whereas someone like Clifford Still, you know, and even the painting looks rugged in a way. He was a rugged individualist in opposition to those other artists. And I'm taken with this painting because we also have a terrific one at the DMA. It's much smaller. But I had seen a lot of Stills, and for many years I wasn't convinced by him in the way I am by other artists. But I look at a painting like this and you really begin to see what an interesting artist he was and the way he used the opposition of the blank untreated canvas and you know, really create a work that looks deeply, deeply impostoed. But when you get close to it, you can see that the paint is in fact just really resting on the surface. So there's this tension and illusion that's really quite beautiful. And then the way he sparingly, you know, injected these shots of color. So on the one hand, you begin to think of a landscape, you know, both an exterior and interior. And I think, you know, it becomes quite organic, but it also is kind of craggy and rough, you know, and has this tension of almost, I would even say, you know, an implicit potential for violence that you don't, you know, something like this also could see to be erupting or potentially erupting. No, and people do, you know, and you can't ignore, you know, the pull that the place you're from has on you and how you represent that, definitely. Mm-hmm. Well, here certainly, you know, and this was probably like a house painter brush, but then, you know, he really did sort of fling the thinned paint a little bit, and that use of the raw canvas, you know, your Morris Lewis that's not up right now. And again, Morris Lewis couldn't have happened without Jackson Pollock, because he took, you know, Pollock's precepts of working into the canvas on the floor, but then, you know, he thinned acrylic paint. And I noticed that's Beaucourt acrylic, the Robert Motherwell. He was a paint producer, and back in the day, just like there used to be department stores, you know, before there were Walmarts, there used to be any number of people who made paints, you know, sort of boutique operations, and Beaucourt was one of them, and artists like Motherwell and like Morris Lewis had, you know, very personal dialogue saying, I'm trying to get paint that does this, and he would, you know, change the formulas for them. So you see this kind of wide range of possibility with acrylic that, you know, hadn't happened because oil paint has certain restrictions in the way you can use it. So all of that, you know, again, in a few short years in the 40s and 50s, around the process of painting and a deep, you know, investment in how you make the painting and what it looks like because of the technique and the tools, you know, these are centuries old relationships of the artist to the craft of the work. But during this period, you see a really rapid evolution of how that was expressed. So on that note, if there are any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Otherwise, thank you all for coming.
Will we lose the house paint earlier, curator-wise, than the acrylics? Will it be easy to...
It's amazing how well those preserved those works are with the house paint. Because, of course, a lot of house paint, most house paint had lead in it back then, you know, which makes it remarkably sturdy.
So if someone were to predict what will happen 100 years from now, I mean, it would not be any less or more than if it was oil or if it was acrylic.
Probably still to be seen.
Okay.
You know?
So it's just sort of an unknown.
Yeah. I mean, it's just one of the exciting and terrorizing things about what we do.
in
the conservation of work.
Nightmare trying to reformulate things that are banned.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes?
When you see those lines overlap, sometimes I think because they do it and want cover, or is just the way you want to do it?
Well, in this is an interesting painting because Robert Motherwell began painting these elegies to the Spanish Republic in about 1956, and then this typology goes on for many, many years. He basically painted the same form over and over and over and over again. But he also has another body of work called the Open Series, where this very gesture becomes the painting. So I would suggest in this it's intentional. And his early works, which I actually really favor, from like 1948 to 1952, 1953, often had a very architectonic structure. Lines, something that would look like a frame of a window, perhaps. So you see that kind of mutating into this later form. Yes? Yeah, Pollock sketched a lot. He was a really, there's also that misapprehension that he couldn't draw. He made beautiful drawings like that one. He also, there are 3 extant sketchbooks, and then there are lots of individual sheets of sketches. I'm just trying to find some. But yes, I mean, most artists draw. I don't know about this series with Motherwell because he painted so many. I think that there aren't a lot of drawings of the Spanish Republic, but he did do other drawings. Gottlieb did a lot of prints. Clifford Still, don't know. It's all, in a foundation. We'll find out soon.
I don't draw a lot. I don't sketch much because when I redo it, when I do it from here to there, I feel like I lose my creativity. Like copying.
Mm-hmm.
I'm losing my time. I already created. I want to create again the same thing. And I waste my time, is what I think. And I just go straight.
Yeah, well, I think a lot of artists do. But a lot of artists have drawing as a separate practice from their painting. Yeah. Yeah, and I think particularly Motherwell was not a particularly spontaneous person.
He was maybe educated to the point of not kind of
release himself. Yeah. Well, thank you all for coming. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. Thanks.